This episode of The Stack was first broadcast on the 3rd of November 2012 on Monocle 24. The Stack, brought to you in association with J.Crew.
The godfather of newspaper design and reinvention, a trusted colleague who knows his way around the page, a chunky magazine with a lofty title, and something fresh for the football pitch. All that plus a lot of crystal ball gazing ahead on edition 10 of The Stack. Also coming up, we'll be hearing about yet another German title hoping to make it big.
This isn't something you can leaf through on the bus. You need space. Laid out on a table, it's 1 meter wide and 70 centimeters tall.
And we'll tour the floors of Midori House in a moment to hear what our colleagues are curling up with this weekend.
There's some really interesting stuff in here. It's really left of center, really quirky. There's pieces on how the cuckoo clock industry in Germany is really struggling.
Lots of reading tips and much more ahead on The Stack here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 10 of The Stack, our weekly view on the world of print media here on Monocle 24. The past few weeks have made for interesting reading as Newsweek announced it's cancelling its paper orders for good, the New York Times saw a dip in its results, Amazon announced its first loss since 2003, the Germans quite literally came out with more print for their newsstands, and here at Monocle headquarters, we closed our biggest issue ever. In an era when analysts are looking for a one-size-fits-all solution to calm markets and find more efficiencies, it's the mission of this program to propose that in many corners of the world, good old media is doing perfectly fine, consumers want a variety of choices, and it's not up to nervous Nellies in boardrooms to proclaim the death of anything. Just because a wave of new tablets hit the market recently, it doesn't mean everyone is going to be converted by Christmas or next summer, or by the time a Silicon Valley darling has a new bit of glass and plastic to push to please investors. We have much to cover over the next 50 or so minutes, but before we do that, we thought we would do a brief tour around Midori House to see what our colleagues are reading at the moment.
My name's Adrian Craddock. I'm the Associate Business Editor at Monocle. At the moment, I'm reading an Australian magazine called Smith Journal. There's some really interesting stuff in here. It's really left of centre, really quirky. There's pieces on how the cuckoo clock industry in Germany is really struggling. There's pieces about a company that's selling a do-it-yourself or make-it-yourself tattoo gun that you can assemble at home. You know, and then there's more straight-laced architectural pieces about people building tree houses and so forth. So lots of really interesting left-of-centre pieces that you wouldn't find anywhere else.
My name is Steve Bloomfield. I'm foreign editor at Monocle. I'm currently reading Bloomberg Businessweek. The cover story today is The Plot to Destroy Germany's Beer, and there's a very good picture of a bottle of Beck's exploding there. Their covers are, on the whole, pretty good. In fact, their whole use of graphics is very good, very good use of infographics as well. It's constantly surprising. You know, a Time or a Newsweek 10 years ago when they were still sort of good, now they're atrocious. They were also relatively predictable. They're about what was happening in the week. Bloomberg Business Week will cover a bit of the week's news, a bit of the analysis, but they're also setting the agenda as well.
My name is David Michel. I am the managing editor at Monocle, and I'm currently reading the Victory Journal, which is a kind of broadsheet sports journal published out of New York City. And I'm not normally the person to read kind of sports publications, but this is a bit more of an intellectual take on sports. So it's everything from fashion to photography to profiles of different sports and sportsmen, really incredibly laid out and really intelligently written.
My name's Tom Edwards. I'm the news editor at Monocle 24. I actually used to work years ago in the fairly distant past on an art magazine, Art Review, which was a contemporary art title published out of London. So I tend to keep an eye on some of the contemporary art magazines. I have here issue 35 of Moose magazine, which is the October-November contemporary art title. It's quite interesting, actually. It's a really very kind of newspapery feel to it, to such an extent that actually when I first upheld the magazine, after I stopped reading it, I checked my hands for newsprint. And it's one of these magazines that's a lot of the main features appear in English and Italian on consecutive pages. It seems to be kind of all the rage to have these ones where it's split pages, but they use that device occasionally. And like I guess a lot of these things, the key medium of communication is more visual, given it's a contemporary art title.
Well, our two guest reviewers are very dear friends. One didn't have to travel so far. One is constantly on a plane, and I will start with Mario Garcia. He's probably recognized as one of the world's foremost newspaper and print and now digital designers. He's also something of a media consultant and doctor as well. Sometimes I wonder, Mario, are you an agony aunt to CEOs around the world of major media companies, especially in this era right now when... If you are a traditional newspaper or magazine company and a CEO calls you up, I mean, do you feel that you're part therapist as much as someone who comes from, you know, the worlds of graphics and understanding grids?
Yeah, I carry a huge bag of teddy bears, and I think that you give them out to publishers, to editors, to insecure art directors, to the whole world. And in this day and age, everyone needs a teddy bear. I mean, they need to be reassured that the industry they're in is going to continue, that it's going to not only continue but thrive, but changes are needed. And that's why I hate the word redesign these days. I'm more into the rethinking business.
Mm. Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, it is, you know, and as we've spoken almost, I would say almost over the last decade, Mary, it is amazing that I've almost sort of seen it move from, of course, you just going into, you know, a company and again, maybe looking at the size and format and the fold and what do you do with a newspaper. But now it is almost like management consultancy, isn't it?
It is. And if you go into a place where they tell you, well, you know, we are sort of digital first in here or print first, I usually say, listen, let's concentrate on the story first. So a lot of what I do these days, you're right, is consulting at a level which is no longer, well, you know, we're tired of Helvetica, let's switch to something else. Mm. That was so 10, 15 years ago. We don't do this anymore, basically.
Yeah. Rich, would you agree? And I'm calling you Rich, but I think most people know your voice. Richard Spencer Powell, our creative director. We've been kicking pages around now for how long? Is it 12, 15? No, how long?
It's 15 years, I think. Years. Yeah. Maybe even 16 next year. Mm. I think it's a decade and a half, basically.
Right. Well, anyway, you'll never proclaim that Helvetica is dead, will you? Or
No, I don't think so. I think when we talk about redesigns, I think it sometimes, more recently, it's a kind of, it's a knee-jerk reaction to bad sales, I think. I think people panic too quickly. And they think by throwing out one typeface and bringing another in, that everything's going to be fixed. But, you know, magazines, newspapers, they're team efforts. Everyone has to be doing their job correctly. It's great that good art direction can increase sales and circulation, and it's something I firmly believe in, but you need both sides of it, really. You need to have good editors, good content, and then the design bit is easy, really.
I mean, Mary, you've waded in and done redesigns on... Maybe just give us a quick CV. I mean, you spent time, I think, on the west coast of Sweden.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you're there. You've spent time in Germany. You're really all over the place and have been recognized for working on a number of major titles. But do you think that's also part of the problem? You know, whether it is an editor-in-chief who calls you in or it's a board member who says, you know, let's have a discussion. We need to evolve something. And as Rich says... Of course, you know, design can address a number of things. The format change can address a lot of things. But I think what we're seeing in newsrooms all over the world right now, are we not? You know, there's a moving of the old guard and some people just saying, look, I was brought in. You can't beat me up for us. I was brought in just to be a columnist. And I don't want to be on camera, to be honest. I just want to write my column. And then you've got, you know, of course, other people saying, well, look at some people, these people need to be quad media today. But you know, you might be sort of comfortable just writing your opinion piece and you've got a great view of the world and that's what you do. But nevertheless, there seems to be a big, you know, issue as well of just really trying to rethink the newsroom floor, not just what grid you're going
to
use.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have to change the mentality of the people, which to me is more difficult that change in the setup, the architecture, or buy-in technology. I'm right now working on my 657th redesign, so you can imagine, in 41 years, how...
Try that on, Rich.
I don't think I could survive 657
anyway,
redesigns.
Anyway, and so I'm still here, as the old singer says in Follies, you know, I'm still here. But part of it is, and I'm usually the oldest person in the room. And so that gives you a certain authority to tell these people, listen, guys, you're 49 years old, you're 55 years old, I have reinvented myself with enthusiasm and passion to cater to all of these new platforms. Why? Because I trained to be a storyteller. I got into this business to tell stories, and these are the best times to tell stories. You can tell stories through audio, through video, and the words are still there. One of the best news that I could probably give anyone who's lamenting is, in all of the research we're doing, whether it's focus groups or through the Poynter Institute, people are now spending more time consuming news than ever before. When we used to do iTrack studies in the 80s, the average American spent 23.3 minutes, for example, in a four-section newspaper. And that was great. Then it went down to 18 or 17. When we do the same test right now, the average person, and we're talking 29, 30 years old, will tell you, I usually spend close to 90 minutes or, you know, more consuming news, but in different settings. And this is what you have to understand, that the whole ritual of, well, I pick up my newspaper or my magazine and I read it in one sitting, that is gone. You don't care how they consume it, but they are coming back to you. And that's the whole idea. You have to engage them so that if they read part of a story and they haven't finished it, they will come back and read it later. We're also seeing multi-platform where a person starts reading the New York Times in the morning in print. I need to go and catch a train. But you're in the middle of a story, so you continue reading the train on the iPhone or on the iPad, whatever. You get to the office and you finish that story on your laptop.
Mm.
And that's basically what editors need to understand.
Yeah, I mean, I know I can vouch for Rich because I think you've probably added at least 30 minutes of news consumption to your day, because Rich is always finding the most bizarre stories about cats on the on the BBC website. You know, whether it's the world's most obese cat in Colombia or somewhere, he always manages to find it somehow, right?
Well, they always seem to manage to find a room on their homepage for the most obese cat in Sussex or whatever the story is. So,
well, I was going to say also there is a bit of a definition of news as well, and I think that, you know, and perhaps, you know, those who are maybe a little bit more precious for what, you know, passes as the news agenda today would say, well, a lot of what fuels the Daily Mail or the Daily Mail's website doesn't really necessarily pass as news. And would you buy that, though? Because, you know, do you think that we're still, maybe are we even consuming less what would be considered world affairs, groundbreaking business stories, etc.? Has that shrunk and there's a little bit more, you know, J-Lo and how she's reinvented her house in Miami?
Yeah, I think that the definition has changed. I mean, generations of journalism students have always used this textbook from 1917 by Lyle Spencer. And he defined news at that time as any story that is of interest to a large number of people. And the story with interest to the largest number of people and with more consequence, that is news, which is still good. But today, news is anything you find out now that you didn't know 15 minutes ago or 15 seconds ago. News basically breaks on Twitter. And that is reason for a lot of editors to sort of throw up their hands in the air and say, well, you know, it's all. But Twitter is only 140 characters. It's like a little tapa. It sort of whets your appetite. And then we as journalists need to take that and run with it and then continue the story, because the people who are on Twitter, for the most, they are witness to an event. A train just crashed, and I take a picture and I tell you this, but they don't know how to develop that story. So definition has changed in that sense.
Do news editors realize that? Because I feel that I mean, there's two things. I think when you look at that as a media channel, on one side, you know, everyone sort of thinks, okay, let's get out there, let's be on Twitter as news organizations, and it will bring people, you know, back to our news brand. And I think you speak to a lot of people today, and what they're finding is that, well, we all think we read the headline and we know everything. Right. So I just go on to the next story. Right. So I think, you know, do you find there's a big question right now? Are we able to go from, you know, whatever has been tweeted to actually getting people back to the front page to read the 1,000 word analysis piece? I guess the second thing, though, is I think a lot of newsrooms also think, well, that's just new citizen journalism, the next phase of citizen journalism. You know what? We don't need anyone in Delhi who knows how to do anything. We don't need anyone in Kuala Lumpur. We'll just let, you know, the reader be our correspondent. Yeah. How do you feel about those two points?
I tell you, the first point you mentioned is the headline. By the time the printed newspaper lost the time advantage. We know that. By the time it comes out, 16 hours after something happened, if you write a headline that smells old, in the old headline-y style with a verb and everything, people say, I already know that. print that succeeds is where you really have two things going on. Reaffirmation, we know that you already know this, but we'll give it to you very quickly. And that is 30%. And then discovery. The more discovery you have in your magazine, in your newspaper, the more that print becomes viable. And that brings me to this point, which I know we'll probably talk about, of Newsweek. As a genre, people say, well, the news magazine is out. No, The Economist is very successful, but The Economist writes a headline that immediately tells, I know about this, but the spin they're putting on the elections in Venezuela, I need to read this because I already know that Hugo Chavez was elected. If you tell me this in the headline, I'd say, oh, they don't do this. Their headline already tells you that what they're going to do is tell you, why did he win?
Mm. Rich, do you think that there's too much amateur creep when you look at what maybe passed as your traditional newspaper? We're always, so often people are demanding comment from the reader. They want everyone to push in. Are you fatigued by this, or do you like that sparring at the bottom of a page, and do you like sort of people dipping their oar in?
I'm not a big fan, to be honest. Every now and again, I'll look at the comments, and I think after three or four comments, it's kind of laughable. I find now, especially with online news, there's so much to kind of skim past. Mm. It's kind of like the back end of a kind of glossy men's title where you get the fractional ads. You just skip past that. It's the kind of bump. It's the bits that fall out of the Sunday supplements. I'm just skimming past the Twitter icons and the reader comments, and very quickly you can scan a page and know exactly which bits are for you and which bits you want to read. So I'm not a big fan of the complexity of it, and I wish there were buttons we could click to turn it off, frankly.
Mm. Jen, we're going to go away for a very short break. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're back in a moment.
J.Crew understands that tradition and modernity often lie hand in hand. That often means looking back in time for inspiration, pairing the integrity of traditional design with modern desires to fit and comfort. As head menswear designer Frank Mauchin says,
we're always inspired by art, architecture, nature, and we look at classic historical menswear, vintage army gear, and those were garments with integrity because they served a purpose. To us, J.Crew is about understated masculine elegance, and we're constantly tweaking proportions to keep the fit current and modern without being trendy, and so we're always moving. What makes it modern, I think, is the fabric and the fit. It's like modern traditionalism almost. The details are traditional, but then the fit, the fabric and the color, that's where you get all your updates.
J.Crew.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24. We are very lucky to be joined by Mario Garcia, a fantastic colleague and certainly good friend of all of us here at Monocle, and also our creative director, Richard Spencer Powell. And amazing that we were able to catch you before you started zipping off somewhere else. You seem to permanently be on Lufthansa. Now, a little bit earlier, Mario, you touched on Newsweek. We picked up a little bit on the story when we were in Toronto 2 weeks ago when news broke that here was this title, which of course is currently looked after by Tina Brown, and that it's going completely digital. It will only exist in an online format. We have, of course, an edition here. I mean, what went wrong? And I think we've all got our own theories on things, and I want to hear from both of you. But what is it, do you think?
Well, every time that a printed publication ceases to publish, we all lament it. I think that this is not happy news. But I saw it coming, and to a lot of people, this has been a reason to write about the news magazine genre dying. Nobody wants a news magazine. And I wrote a blog about this. I said, no, The Economist is thriving in the U.S. There are news magazines in Europe that do extremely well, but they have reinvented themselves. If you look at this Newsweek, there is very little difference between the Newsweek of now and the Newsweek of 10 years ago. They still will do the traditional formula of a cover story of 7 to 9 pages. That's from another era. I mean, long doesn't necessarily mean that this is where people are going to invest their time. So the flow of the book is faulty. The fact that they could be very tabloidy on a cover story one day and then try to be serious the next, you've got to focus. You've got to have an idea of who you are when you go out. And I think that this must have frustrated the designers who didn't know how to dress this magazine. Either you're going to be a good girl or you're going to be a bad girl, but you cannot go out one week as one and then next week as something else. So to me, the genre needs to evolve and is evolving successfully. But what happened to Newsweek had little to do with a news magazine concept and more with the content that was put in there.
Rich, what's your view? I mean, I thought, you know, oddly, it went very, on some sides, it became very sans serif. It became very chilly. I mean, if we're just going to speak about design right now, stories aside, I found it wasn't as friendly. And I think what's interesting is, you know, before we went on air, Mary, we were up in my office looking at that wonderful photograph that one of our photographers gave of the Der Spiegel building in Hamburg, the old Der Spiegel building, which is just is wonderful. But no matter what, you look at that orange border and you look at that serif font. But I mean, somehow Der Spiegel is your friend. It might get up your nose. It might annoy you. But, you know, nevertheless, week in, week out, it is there 200 plus pages. And I think that's one thing. I'm not sure. I sort of feel like I felt like I was less and less, you know, we're talking about a tactile experience here. I didn't feel like I was getting value every week. And I, you know, I think obviously we look at a lot of titles today, you know, people want a thud factor as
Absolutely.
Well. And they don't want the flutter factor where it sort of just drifts onto a table. Rich, what's your view?
Yeah, I think, taking up Mario's point about the covers changing, I think sort of schizophrenia in design, especially in covers, is a bad thing. It shows lack of direction, it shows lack of confidence, and I think readers pick up on that, and you just don't quite know where you are with it. You do with The Economist, and you do with Der Spiegel and Stern, and I think they probably should have invested a little bit more in the design. I think they should have kept it tighter and cleaner, and a bit bolder on the cover. You know, Newsweeklies, there are, it is a tough market. And I think you've got to get the cover right and you've got to stick with it. I think they should have got themselves a nice theme, been a bit more impactful and run with it for longer. And I think it just smarts of, lack of confidence, really.
Doctor, what is your prognosis? Because it's one thing, I think, if you are The Economist or you're Der Spiegel and you say, look, you know, we are going to give up on the print edition, but you can, you know, if you're Der Spiegel, you are the number one news website in Germany, and you've already created a strong subscription model for your digital edition anyway. So you've got two revenue streams, one for just the traffic, the free version, everyone going to your site every week, and then, of course, what people are paying to have the digital subscription. I would imagine at that point you can confidently go there. But what happens with Newsweek when I don't feel it is a website that people are running to either?
Well, I think that this is all about brand extension, and you cannot extend a very weak brand successfully. And that's what it is. I mean, if they were not following you here, chances are that this has very little to do with the fact that people are more digitally minded as opposed to print minded. This is about a brand that stopped being viable, that stopped giving people something that they needed and that they felt they needed to come back to, which is what happened with The Spiegel and The Economist. You must come back to these publications because they engage you.
Yeah.
You need them.
I wonder if we're going to see a resuscitation. Part of me almost thinks it was quite surprising, and maybe it wasn't surprising then to see that, of course, Barry Diller, who is the major financier behind this, then had not particularly good results for the rest of his company the week after. So obviously this was also a bit of a boardroom discussion. Again, rather knee-jerk. Okay, let's cut the paper bill. Let's cut the print bill. We're going to get out of this business. Then you see that they have bad results the next week as well. I was slightly surprised that, you know, that we didn't see the Qataris come in and say, we've got Al Jazeera. Why don't we have a strong news brand? And you know what? We'll keep the office in New York, but we'll reinvent this for the Middle East or something. I still sort of wonder if not that there's necessarily going to be a night on the horizon, but whether someone actually might pick this title up still as well.
I mean, there's no reason why it can't work.
Yeah,
I think with the right team in place, the right design, and as long as they recognize that they need to design specifically for the platform that they're going to run it on, be it print or design. I think you mentioned the Daily Mail earlier, and if you look at the Daily Mail's newspaper, it's completely different to its website. Its website is enormously successful because they've thought about what people want to look at online. And yeah, there's their news, but there's all the, you know, there's all the kind of trashy gossip, which I think that gets like 60 million hits a day, I think, the Daily Mail. It's crazy. But I think if Newsweek were to be rescued, I think they need to really very seriously consider what's best for each of these platforms. And yeah, again, just invest in the design and try and offer something different that the others aren't doing.
Absolutely. We're going to just come back in a moment and we're going to dive into the stack of the week. Now, gentlemen, I didn't make you do too much homework. I brought the magazines along this week. And, Rich, I thought I would start with you. I'm not sure if this hit your desk yet, but this is it's a new football title, which is called Howler. And it just says it's a magazine about soccer. And I think we should maybe start, maybe just take us through the cover, what you have there.
Well, it's an illustrated cover of a kind of skateboard kind of graphic in a way. It's, yeah, like a sort of 60s comic, I suppose. Gentleman on a football pitch on fire holding up a bloody skull. So kind of like your average Saturday in England on a football terrace, I suppose. Quite large format. When I say soccer, I'm assuming it's... No, it isn't. It's actually all types of football, including...
Yes, football or
US
soccer, yeah. Exactly.
Soccer, obviously the American word for it.
And Canadian.
And Canadian, of course.
just the market for football stroke soccer magazines, and this one, what I find is interesting, it almost feels like an art piece when you look at it at first glance, just because of this very graphic cover. But do you think this is, you know, we've got sort of Green Soccer Journal, there's so many titles, you know, that have also moved into this sort of indie market. Is this the indulgent exercise of just someone who is probably a passionate editor, art director, who just loves the sport and thinks that, you know what, the newspapers don't do a very good job of it. There's so much more emotion that you want to get off the pitch. So therefore, it needs to live in this kind of monthly format. What do you think?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, there are different types of football, soccer fan. And I think there are the people that go to the games and they probably just read the more traditional football magazines, which are just interviews with players and, you know, histories of clubs. And then there's the people that are perhaps slightly older that don't really go to the games, that just follow the analysis, be it online or the sports pages of the weekend papers. And I think there's probably room there for people that are genuinely fans of football, but they don't necessarily want to kind of get down and grubby with it.
Right.
I think it's a difficult time to be involved in football journalism at the moment, because I think post-Olympics there's been a bit of a backlash. A lot of people are not interested in the sport at the moment. And there's been, of course, a few scandals.
Wait, just because people have been titillated by so many other sporting pursuits, you think? Or,
well, I think there's that, and I think there was
or
so much...
Or just sport fatigue?
Not fatigue, I think. I think just that the Olympics was such a kind of proud, clean event. And then you get back to football and it's, you know, awful NAF cars, you know, people having affairs, racism. I think it just feels a bit grubby right now.
Right.
And there's been quite a bit of comment about there's just a lack of enthusiasm for the sport right now.
Does it engage you, Mary, as you flip through it?
It does. I think that this is probably one of the most sophisticated publications I've seen about football / soccer. This is probably an art director, like you say, who is a football fan, or perhaps a heavy-duty football fan who is a closet designer. The magazine is very well put together. Mm. I think that it has the graphics. It has, for starters, it doesn't open with a picture of a celebrity. I mean, the illustration, in 10 seconds, you are engaged here, because there is a subtle kind of style to this illustration. The typography is beautifully presented, and I noticed that sans serif prevails here. So they decided that, you know, Sunserif is more macho, and so why not? The graphics are engaging too, and yeah, this is a very good lean back experience for someone who is into this topic. And you know that the people who are not into football are not going to come back here, except for art directors who would like to get ideas from here.
Right. Rich, you brought, we had Roller magazine, which is, of course, a much-loved cycling magazine. When we were chatting about that, also with its editor a couple of weeks ago. But you brought another cycling magazine in as well.
Yeah, this was one that caught my eye this week, actually. This is the second issue. I thought it was the first, but it's actually the second issue of a new title called Cyclist. Nice masthead design. Similar kind of trim size and paper format to our magazine. And it's just quite nicely put together. And I thought this, again, is this something that's been launched on the back of the success of the Olympics and
right.
the British cycling team and Tour de France? It seems like a lot of these sort of athletics, running magazines, they're all a bit kind of business to business. They're never that well designed, I don't
right.
think. And this looks like an earnest attempt to kind of get people to buy it that aren't, that are more than just cycling at the weekends. You know, it's kind of tries to offer for all courses, really.
Yeah, and what's interesting as well is it feels a little bit independent. As you said, I would love a running magazine that was this well. I mean, I think we always talk about the, I mean, you know, there's Runner's World, and you pick it up because you want to see if has Asics done a new trainer or something. But there's still, I'm still waiting for it. Oddly, though, I was just looking at the masthead. This is put out by Dennis Publishing, so it feels indie, yet it's from one of the bigger you know, players, certainly in this market. I mean, also Dennis is quite significant in the United States. Mary, I'm waiting for you two to come up with. You're a keen runner, but it's, don't you look at that and you sort of think, oh, I really wish that there was
absolutely
because I mean we've been talking about some of the ones that have come out of Japan. Of course, Corner Magazine,
yeah.
fantastic, which is a collabo with Nike. But I don't know. I look at that and I'm wondering where the running and jogging version is of that, Maria.
It hasn't happened, but this one on cycling, I mean, it's just beautifully done. I like the tempos. I mean, magazines are like symphonies. You have to have violins and trombones. And a lot of these magazines, in fact, the one on football is more a one sort of tone symphony. The Cyclist, by just in 10 seconds, you get this feel that they're going to have the longer narratives. They're going to do the violins, and then suddenly trombones, you have five or six short items, and the tempo goes back to, they have managed to do this much better here, just at a glance, than Howler, where everything seems to be, well, you're going to join this symphony, but it's going to be slow version, long narratives about football. Here, the tempos are very visible, and I think that this is part of probably what the designer managed to accomplish through typography and so on. I mean, you have the longer pieces, but then you always have the finger readings, you know, to guide you. So I think that this one is a very good surprise. I wish they would do it. Ronnie, maybe you will, Tyler.
Yeah, I know. Rich and I always talk about it. Now, I passed over the Alpine Review to you, which is, this is a big, weighty, twice-yearly magazine published out of Montreal, printed in Barcelona. And it calls itself a magazine for the things that matter. And you've got you know, various agencies featured and products and a range of paper stocks and... This is a tome. It's almost a book, Mario. Is this in one way where publishing is going to increasingly end up? Publishing is going to have to feel like it matters. When I say publishing, meaning when we're talking about ink on paper.
Yeah, I think that this one, I never saw it before. It does feel like a textbook in your hands, but it really, you know, we make decisions about these publications, the average person, in 10 seconds. Used to be 35 seconds, whatever. In 10 seconds you make, what is it that this one tells me? It tells me, lean back with me, read me over the course of maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever. It really says a lot, but it also says important. It has this sense of seriousness about it. You know that you are going to be engaged by this publication. I don't know if I would call it a magazine.
No, exactly.
Not at all.
Yeah, I mean, they've got this red cover varnish, which also sort of reveals, and I like how it's just got this slight sort of dip and sort of to reveal that this is the title opened and how they use that as a device. But so they've gone with this anti-fragility theme. It says a handbook on seeing things coming, city, Berlin, the city of now. And then it's topics they talk about, new aesthetics, old aesthetics. John Colco on sense making, the unplanned economy, why own, paths to resilience, 60 ideas to explore. And it's... there's something about it when I look at it that, again, and I don't, I always feel with my magazine reading diet, I've got those which go on my desk and that I have to look at and deal with them that day. And, you know, you saw my desk upstairs, yeah. Just now. I mean, there's loads of print on it. And then there's those which come home in the evening. And then I've got those which I really want to savor. And I think when I look at the Alpine Review, yeah. I want to save that for, you know, next weekend when I've really got time and I know I've got 3 hours. You talk about sort of the lean back experience or whether it's the lie down experience, whatever it is, but you really want to spend time with it.
This one really is, it's a good example of what we call, of what our mutual friend William Powers calls the power of disconnect. Mm. You know you will disconnect totally, yeah. When you have this magazine / book in your hands.
Rich?
I think it's lovely. It's my kind of mag, actually. If I saw this, I'd be prepared to pay whatever the price is. I wouldn't be surprised if it's up to £10-15. And I would look at it and keep it in very nice condition and put it on my bookcase and probably get it down again 6 months on. And it would still be quite timeless. They've been very conservative and safe with the design, which I like. And there's a number of these magazines now that they never seem to get more than 2 issues out a year. Mm. And I always get quite excited when they come out, and I'll probably buy the first 3, and then I seem to stop because I kind of think after 3, I've had enough.
Right.
And then I find I kind of move on to whatever the next one is. But it's interesting what you say about you have different magazines for different times of the day or times of the month or certain occasions. And from a design side of things,
well,
this is one that appeals
seems
to me.
It seems that Howler did okay. Mary, you like The Cyclist, and looks like it's 2 thumbs up for the Alpine Review. You are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We are going away for a short break. When we come back, we're going to look at a magazine with a rather triple XL format. We're back in a moment.
The designers at J. Crew feel that the best garments involve a mix of smart detail and solid functional design. As head menswear designer Frank Malchens explains, J. Crew's favorite products are the ones that start with smart design but last long enough to make them the customer's own.
It's, to me, the Lolo is a classic suit but with a modern edge almost, but without it being trendy. And I think what we are in J. Crew here is we're looking for longevity and for classic garments which can lead a life. Like if you have a khaki pant, we make sure it's nicely washed already again, but you still have to do the work yourself again. You know, like year after year, the wash gets better and it gets softer and it molds around your body. The same goes for denim. And I think also that's a way to give a garment personality.
J. Crew.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and our guests Mario Garcia and resident Richard Spencer Powell. While the rest of the media downsizes and digitizes, a new German bilingual art magazine has just hit international newsstands, which defies all the current trends. It's experimenting with a whole new style and an opulent double XL or even triple XL format. With Germany's leading paper manufacturer Hannemüller Fine Art behind it, it's all about a passion for paper. Its first edition was just awarded the prestigious Red Dot Design Awards, but is it a good read? And how do you get it home? Abby Darcy went to find out.
Can you handle it? That's what the new German art magazine Upon Paper asks on its website. And they don't mean the content. This isn't something you can leaf through on the bus. You need space. Laid out on a table, it's 1 metre wide and 70 centimetres tall. And to get a good look at it, I had to read it standing up.
Welcome to the opening of our current exhibition.
The artwork gets even more room here. Full-scale prints from the current edition go on show in the Upon Paper space in Berlin, and there are plans for similar exhibitions in London and Stockholm too. Holger Hohmann is the editor-in-chief.
I think we're part of a dinosaur species, endangered species. Nowadays, everybody seems to be in a rush. You know, it's a quick a look at things and a quick what comes next. And it's an ocean of mediocrity. We actually took it very literally to be outstanding in a way. So it's a kind of a challenge. And all of a sudden you find, oh, it's quite a new rhythm of doing things, which is slower, more intense. And we like to share it with people who have or have in common this kind of a love affair. We are in love with paper, everything which is on paper.
This isn't just a German love affair. The magazine is bilingual and distributed globally. This second edition is an explosion of colour. There are the first experiments in colour photography by a Russian chemist, studies of psychedelic birds by Nick Knight, and a look at colour through the lens of the Bauhaus, as well as photos from a secretary in the French embassy in China, Solange Brand.
China was completely closed at that time. It was the hidden part of the world. So I arrived there. It was my first photos. I discovered the country. I was leaving school. I was leaving my parents. I got to China just a few months before the start of the Cultural Revolution. With my first money, I bought, of course, in Hong Kong, a camera, Pentax. And I've discovered the passion of photography. I just shot what I could see. They have been made without any intention to be shown. They were made for myself. Memory of the Chinese, you know, there are photos, family photos and so on. It's in black and white. The few journalists coming from outside, they were working in black and white also because they were working for the press, and the press was in black and white. You know, you have the whole story like this, and you don't have many documents in color.
Upon paper isn't bound, it's just held together by a cord, so you can pull out the double spreads and even hang them on the wall. It's funded by Hahnemüller Fine Art, a company which has produced paper for artists for over four centuries. Helder Zuffenplan is the creative director of Upon Paper.
I think there's a special focus on really pushing the limits of what is possible in print in Germany. We really went to the limit when it comes to the size. We try to do unusual things with the printing process and also with the pre-printing. For some of the sheets, we decided to use spot colors, special colors, to match the original artworks. And we also used colors that have very high pigmentation, so they're very bright and very consistent. We have one painting by Kim Gordon, the singer of Sonic Youth, who is also an acclaimed artist. It would be almost impossible to reproduce it in the regular printing, offset printing, because there's a really bright pinkish rhodamine red in it.
The pages are thick, just turning them needs care. Images take up full sides, uncluttered by text. At a Berlin cafe, the art critic Antje Stahl tells me she's in two minds.
Most of the people I talked to, they were really angry at the fact that someone published such a format because you can't read it and you can't store it. Upon Paper is definitely like a manifesto for the paper, for the actual object. The content works very well. It's a very fine selection. It kind of digs, you know, within the visual culture. They really have a great expertise. But then obviously the question is, couldn't you also publish that in another format, you know, that is maybe a little bit more handy? I don't know.
Editor-in-chief Holger Hormann says the project is about challenging the conventions of publishing.
It's not so much to catch the zeitgeist. We're not in competition with the genre of magazine and its players. It's like curating your own kind of space, your own gallery with images and content. So this gives it a very unique twist.
The magazine has the look and price tag of a collector's item. It's a sort of mobile gallery, like opening up your own personal exhibition at home. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Abby Darcy.
We had to take that brief interlude just to load the magazine into the studio. It almost takes up the entire table, Upon Paper magazine. And again, as we were discussing the Alpine Review earlier, it's not really a magazine. What type of expression is this to you, Mary? I mean, of course, it's an exercise. You have a big German paper company who wants to go out and sell their wares. Do you like seeing this kind of statement?
I think so. This is the magazine as artifact.
Mm.
I mean, it's... obviously, it's not very portable, but it's very showable.
Mm.
I mean, I would love to have a magazine like this on my coffee table. I think it would be interesting, and it really is quite a statement about the power of print. I mean, this is not
and the role of
minimized and the role of print.
Yeah,
you could not do this digitally, and so I think that this is what, to me, this is a statement about who says that paper is dead. Paper is bigger and better.
Absolutely, Rich.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think
You're taking it all in, aren't you?
Well, it's quite a lot to take in. I mean, it's almost A1 in size.
Mm.
But yeah, it is a complete celebration of print. And along the bottom of the cover there, it lists some of the photographers, and one of them's Nick Knight. So as a reader, you can see straight away that you're probably going to get a full-page image by Nick Knight, which is like an A1 Nick Knight poster. So that is something that digital cannot offer at all. Personally, I don't ever enjoy the impracticality of this type of scale.
Right.
I think the only...
Even for the coffee table and the statement piece.
I think even for a coffee table, you need a big one to kind of get that a full spread out. I think it's more, for me, it's something nice to have in the office. You need an editor's desk, actually. I think you need to be able to spread that one out. Or a boardroom.
Yeah.
But, yeah, for the designers, however, we really are in very interesting times because just today, I mean, in the last 24 hours, National Geographic has done their iPhone edition, which is quite readable. And so here we have, I just read about this, and now I'm looking at this gigantic magazine. And I think this is the way the world will move. For us designers, journalists, you'll have to really go from very small canvases to very large canvases, and they will all coexist. I'm not saying that there will be many magazines this big, but this is a statement to the power of paper. I don't care. You could be a 12-year-old and you would be mesmerized by the photos, by the imagery here. That is the same as it was 50 years ago. I mean, I am mesmerized by the images here.
Excellent. Jen, we're going to take a very short break, and we'll probably come back with some parting thoughts, because I want to pick up just before we go. And I know we were talking a little bit earlier about, I think some elements of fatigue, and Rich, we're speaking about the whole point of how much, reader comment you want. But I want you just to think about, before we go away, this notion of this unilateral view that we have of the marketplace, that we always sort of move to sort of, one size fits all. So we'll position that as our parting thoughts. You're listening to The Stack. Back in a second. And it is almost time to go. But before we all part company today, it was interesting at the top when I was just reading my intro to the program. It's amazing to look at the media landscape in general right now, Mario. And so many people are sort of forcing us, down one path. Everyone's looking for efficiencies today, and that there should be one solution. As you're saying, should everyone be looking at their media brand only off of the iPhone, or should everyone, only be consuming it on a satellite TV channel? When you go and you have a serious conversation with someone who is running a big media organization, do you often have to tell them, say, look, it's not going to be, a one-option buffet for people where you're only going to get noodles. In fact, it's going to be a proper buffet, and there's going to be a variety of things. You want canapés at the front, you can have those. And if you want to make your own sundae down the back, you can do that as well.
Absolutely. I think it's the biggest sundae brunch you ever saw in your life, with mimosas at the end. Okay? And if you don't want the orange juice, you just drink straight champagne. And I think that this is the way we have to look at it. And the time cycles is not about editions. I hate it when people say, well, we do this at 10 o'clock, we close this edition. I think you have a 24-hour cycle, and you have to adjust to the lifestyles of people in what I call this media quartet. You serve some people on the telephone. So far, we know that people do not read extensively on the telephone. So you have these lean-forward platforms. The phone and the online are all day long. We are consulting those. What I want here is updated headlines. You will see probably fewer photo galleries and videos online because those are constantly updatable platforms. Then you have the lean back. Usually after 6 p.m. or whatever, you have print and the tablet. And if you understand the differences here, then your newsroom can cater to that. The lean forward, constantly updating headlines, newsier. and the others, more narratives, more multimedia, more multisensory. You have to understand that. In most newsrooms, this is not clear yet. Mm.
I mean, Rich, Mary refers to sort of lean back. You're sort of more feet up, aren't you, than anything else?
Not in this outfit, I'm not, Tyler, no.
On that point about the buffet, I'm wondering what your view is. And of course, we're in the midst of also looking at relaunching our website here, which is about a month away until we have a complete overhaul of what we're doing. And we're looking and playing with sort of volume and pitch and range and where do we want to be? And I think that this has, of course, been an extraordinary experiment, which has now gone, it's gone beyond that now. It is, radio is a big part of what we do. But we've found a complementary world. And do you feel, sometimes you might see an amazing new app, you look at a new website and you think, okay, do we have to run after that as Monocle as a brand, or you think that this is something you're pursuing, or do you think it's all right to just pick one or two battles?
I think it's all right to pick one or two battles. I think print is obviously something that's very important, and I think, Mary, you're right. I think we do our reading in the evening. I increasingly, when I finish work, when I go home, I don't want to put the television on. I might read the news on my phone on the way in, but I don't really look at it on the way home. When I get home, it's more I read, it's magazines, it's newspapers that I look at. Mm. And I don't think you need to chase after every app. I think something that's happened a little bit in website design lately is this kind of thinking that it's not really about creating a website, it's more about creating a program. Like iTunes is actually a program, and yet it feels like a website. And I think people just want to make their websites operate like little button pushing programs. And I think if you can do that, you can access things very, very quickly. The BBC website is like that. The Guardian website is like that. Is it News Today? Or was it USA Today relaunched? It's a very kind of easy to navigate. It feels like an app on your phone. It's very kind of clickable, because I think people just want to get to the bit they want very quickly in between their five-minute journey to work.
Rich, just before we go, do you think that people the consumer is at the point where they're, a little bit tired of just, being pushed away, link me here, jump here?
Yeah, I think so. And I think if you can make an engaging website or app, whether it's on, a MacBook Air or it's on the new iPad mini, I think if you can make something engaging and fast to navigate, and yes, you do just want to sit down on the couch or lie down and stay with it for a long time, I think the consumers are going to be desperate to buy it, to subscribe to it. I think people do just want to have a little bit of time out. It's quite, frenetic out there on newsstands and websites. So a bit of calm amongst all of that, I think, would be, recipe for success, I'd imagine.
Perfect send-off for a Saturday afternoon. Mario Garcia, Richard Spencer-Powell, thanks very much for joining us. And that brings us to the end of this 10th edition of The Stack. We are going to, be having a little bit more this afternoon. We have the review a little bit later on. Today's program was produced by Don Trump. Our studio manager is Toby Hammond. And, of course, if you have any comments or queries or you want to send us any great print, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Of course, you can send everything along to 1 Dorset Street here in W1 in the heart of London. Of course, we're back the same time next Saturday. And of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. But for now, for me, Tyler Burleigh, goodbye. Have a great weekend.